This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, are college athletes employees, and can they unionize? In one key labor ruling, the answers are yes and yes. A regional director of the National Labor Relations Board ruled this week that men's basketball players at Dartmouth College should be considered employees of the school, and as a result, they're eligible to form a labor union. The NCAA and Dartmouth are expected to appeal the decision. Players have not set a date yet for a potential vote to form a union. But the NLRB regional director gave an answer to one of the great debates in college sports. Are student athletes truly unpaid amateurs, or do they provide labor that is compensated in ways that qualify as employment? What happens next with the Dartmouth men's basketball team has the potential to change the landscape of college sports even more. And our next guest is here to help us understand where things go from here. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think college athletes should be considered employees of their schools and treated accordingly? Should they be allowed to unionize if they want to? What questions do you have about this ruling and the state of labor in college sports? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Leroy is professor of labor and employment relations and an affiliated member of the College of Law faculty at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Happy to join you.
Can you tell us a little more about this ruling? It's an NLRB regional director. It's not at the top of the charts here, but what is this ruling? What does it mean?
Well, I think the way you set it up is accurate. For perspective, this is the second time we've had a regional director make this kind of ruling. We had a Chicago a regional director similarly rule in 2014 when Northwestern's football team filed a petition for a union representation election. You spelled out there's an appellate process. In the Northwestern case, it went to the full five-member labor board in Washington, and they unanimously voted that they don't have jurisdiction of the matter. It's not that they ruled on the employee or amateur issues per se. Because the Big Ten had only one private school at that time, and the rest were public, and Rob, crucially, because the National Labor Relations Act only extends to public employers and public employees, it was basically a moot point whether Northwestern could unionize or not. If they went forward with the union, the players would be paid. They'd be subject to sanctions from the NCAA. The school would be subject to sanctions. And in any event, the board emphasized collective bargaining can't take place with one school. Now, what makes Dartmouth a different story 10 years later is it's in the Ivy League. The entire conference is private. The entire conference could unionize. There's no reason that you can't have a bargaining unit with the Ivy League. So in that sense, we're in new territory.
Now, things have changed a lot in college sports since that 2014 ruling, including kinds of compensation athletes can get. What is different, if anything, about the landscape now as it relates to this ruling? It's a different time, magically, 10 years later.
Well, you put it perfectly. In 2012, I published a law review article with the Wisconsin Law Review, and I imagined a process by which amateur athletes could bargain for non-wage matters, such as a grievance process, such as better health care, things of that nature that are not wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. And that really sort of reflects what you're saying is where we were 10 years ago, 12 years ago. But since that time, just in the Big Ten, we have a $7 to $10 billion contract for Big Ten schools. The conference has expanded to 18. And there's just a totally different aura or feeling. Not to mention we have name, image, and likeness or NIL rights for athletes. And so there's money everywhere you turn in college athletics. So also, we had a 2021 Supreme Court decision called the Alston case, A-L-S-T-O-N, in which the Supreme Court unanimously cast serious doubt on the amateurism model. So all of that means that even if we're looking at a very similar kind of union representation case in Dartmouth as compared to Northwestern, the context has fundamentally shifted. There's no pretending anymore that big-time college athletics is an amateur enterprise.
Well, I'll pretend for a moment. I could see an argument going along these lines. They go to practice. These athletes, they play. They don't get an hourly wage. They don't have a salary. They don't have the kind of direct compensation I would think of an employee getting. So they're not really employees. Is that something that's been part of this argument?
Yes. I mean, that basically summarizes the NCAA's position. And for full disclosure, I should tell you, I filed a friend of the court brief in a different matter on behalf of athletes. The case is Johnson versus NCAA. And it's a lawsuit by Ralph Trey Johnson, a football player at Villanova, and other student athletes in colleges and universities throughout the Northeast. They're alleging that they're misclassified as amateurs, that they're employees. Now, back to your observation, my brief informed the court that the test for an employee really comes down to six factors, the chief of which is control of somebody's time when they are performing a service that benefits the supposed employer. There are other elements as well, but it's fundamentally a matter of control of time. And so I do think we have passed the threshold for ruling that at least some college athletes meet the standards for employment.
Michael Leroy is with us from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, professor of labor and employment relations there, talking about college athletes and their amateur status. A labor relations board, a regional ruling says, well, maybe they are employees and could unionize if they want to. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael, one point I want to dig into here now, Dartmouth, the school at the center of the story, private college. Let's go here to Wisconsin, UW-Madison, public college. If I'm hearing things right, this ruling wouldn't affect them because they're at the public college level. But say the Marquette University basketball team, a private school, this might affect them. Do I have that right?
That's perfectly understood. You've got it. If I could add one more layer of understanding, separate from what you and I are talking about right now, the NLRB has a case pending before an administrative law judge involving the University of Southern California and the Pac-12 Conference and the NCAA. And in that case, the NLRB is testing out its theory that the conference and NCAA are joint employers of the USC football team. Now, this concept of joint employment, where the joint employer being the NCAA and a conference, is crucial to your question, because if that ruling comes out in favor of the NLRB, then if we shift our focus to UW-Madison, the Big Ten by implication and the NCAA by implication would be also joint employers of that public university. And so that's in the mix here.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dwayne is with us in Westfield. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, how you doing? For years, I mean, the colleges have never allowed their students to be paid to be professional athletes. And then, like you said, in that 2014 ruling, it's still, I mean, these people are getting millions. I mean, they're getting money paid from sponsors and so on and so forth. But they're also still getting, like, scholarships and stuff. So, and you're saying also they're trying to unionize. It seems like they're trying to get everything they want early before they even get into the professional level. So why, I mean, they know they're going to make it into the professional level anyway, so why are they pushing for all this other free money that they're trying to get when other people are struggling through schools?
Dwayne, I gotcha. And I think there might be two different groups here, Michael. There might be some elite athletes in particular sports with prospects going to professional careers and very big scholarships. And as a parent of a D3 athlete, there are those who don't get those athletic scholarships and, you know, aren't looking at a professional career. There's a couple different categories involved in Dwayne's question.
Right. Well, those are good distinctions. Dwayne has a really good question, a really good call. So it Dwayne's question boils down to what's your philosophy about what a student should be getting? I mean, we live in interesting times. I work on a college campus. Some of the highest paid people in my community are very probably basketball players and football players. I don't have specific information. I've done research on NIL. A different school has shared their database with me on NIL compensation. Their highest paid athlete is $350,000. That's more than most professors and most administrators make. And that kind of speaks to Dwayne's point. On the other hand, when you look at the legal test of employment, those things really don't matter. And what I mean by that is, you know, people make the argument, well, many sports don't break even or make a profit. The minimum wage law applies to an employer even if they're losing money. The wage law applies even if somebody's getting wonderful bonuses, wonderful benefits. And that's sort of my answer back to Dwayne about all of that is true. If I could add one more interesting observation to Dwayne's really fine question. In the early 1950s, the Southeastern Conference initiated for the first time the awarding of scholarships to athletes. Now, today we look at that as just a basic part of the social contract between players and schools at big institutions, not D3 and D2, as you've noted, Rob. But I would point out that that was considered a violation of NCAA rules. That was considered pay for play, even though it was a scholarship. So my point is that our definition of what is compensation and what is appropriate has shifted over time.
Dwayne, thanks for that call. We're talking to Michael Leroy, labor relations professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, looking at the potential for college athletes to unionize after a National Labor Relations Board ruling on men's basketball players at Dartmouth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of college athletes being considered and treated as employees of the university they play for? Do you think players are being compensated fairly by schools? Do you think that it should be more straightforward? Pay to play. Would that be okay? If you are or were a college athlete yourself, love to hear your perspective. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Michael Leroy, professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's with us to talk about a ruling by a National Labor Relations Board regional director that determined that the Dartmouth men's basketball team, the players are employees of the college, this ruling says, eligible to unionize if they want. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts on college athletes and athletics and compensation and amateur status at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Hi, Chris.
Hi. So my question is, I have no problem with these people being paid or, you know, compensated for their likeness. But at what point do we start discussing potentially divorcing college athletics from academia? It seems like two competing business models and one kind of overshadowing the other. Why doesn't these seem like minor leagues for professional sports? So why doesn't the professional sports in some capacity take this up on their own and the rest of us can go to school for science or math or technology, what have you? What about divorcing these two from one another and having them be their own separate entities?
Chris, thanks for the call. Michael.
Chris, that's a great observation. I happen to share your viewpoint. It's time to start thinking about that for the major athletic programs. To your point, I'm intrigued by the Green Bay Packers ownership model, which I'm a little out of my depth here. But as I understand it, it's based on some concept of a fan ownership. But in any event, the idea that I'm getting at is it's conceivable that you could, instead of having an NIL model that uses donor support to fund sort of a shadow payroll for large college football teams and basketball teams, why not have a joint venture where the university retains a 51% interest in the corporate entity, and the fans buy shares in the remaining 49%. You license out all the branding and the administration of the team to this joint venture corporate entity. I would just observe, too, to Chris's point here, on major college campuses, there are joint ventures that take place between public universities and private entities. They usually involve new technologies that the university is licensing and they're looking for a partner. It's not a strange concept that a university goes into business with a partner and they try to make money together. So I think this idea has merit.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Michael, I want to talk a little bit about what a unionized college sports team might look at. Now, Dartmouth, this is where this ruling was. They're not, I believe, a powerhouse basketball team. They may not ever get paid money. If they unionize, though, what kind of things could they negotiate about with the university?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is negotiate for scholarships. This goes back to, I think, Dwayne's call. Negotiate for a scholarship. They can't by rule. They can't get a scholarship and they can't get cost of attendance. And at Dartmouth and other Ivy League schools, the cost of attending their schools is over $300,000 for 4 years. And interestingly, that wouldn't violate the NCAA's rules. But, you know, they could go after many other things. There are some not so obvious matters they could negotiate for. First of all, as employees, they would have the ability to seek an outside investigation if they experienced racial harassment, just as an illustration. There is, unfortunately, some degree of coaching mistreatment of athletes. Employees have more protections than non-employees. And so there are different things they can do. They could also negotiate for benefits for disabilities and injuries that last beyond their eligibility. We have this idealized vision of college athletics, but in fact, when college athletes exhaust their eligibility, for the most part, if they're injured, if they have a long-term nagging injury that impairs their ability to work or so forth, they are on their own. They don't have workers' compensation. They don't have disability insurance.
Now, this would be a unique kind of workplace in that the whole team turns over every 4 years or so as players graduate and move on. Can you see that being assuming we end up at a point where we have unionized college sports teams, how would that function?
Great question. Well, my answer to that is, first of all, at least in the past year, we've seen reporting that the typical Amazon fulfillment center has 150% turnover in a year. And whether that's exactly right or not, I'm just rhetorically asking, how many Amazon fulfillment center workers work for 4 years continuously? My guess is it's a small number. And then I would say, if you look at the NFL, the average career is 3 years. You know, certainly people like Patrick Mahomes are going to play for hopefully, you know, 15 years, but rosters turn over a lot. So the very fact that you've got this constant churn or turnover just as a function of eligibility really isn't all that much different than many other workplaces. Just think of your local favorite coffee shop. I don't want to give a name, but whatever it is, do you see the same people there over a 5-6 year period? At least at my coffee shop, I don't see them at this, you know, I don't see the same folks. There's a lot of turnover there.
Looking into the future now, something we haven't talked about much is the bizarre consolidation of conferences, the generation of these super conferences. Might we end up with kind of two completely different answers to a lot of the questions we're talking about, one for the so-called power teams and one for everybody else?
It feels like we're moving in that direction. It feels like the current roster, I mean, the incoming roster of the 18 Big Ten schools and I think we're going to have 16 SEC schools. That gives you 34 schools that have attracted about 75% of the top tier college football players in the current signing season. They've got the best TV contracts locked up. If you take a look around the professional leagues, they have 30 to 32 teams. 34 college teams make sense from a marketing standpoint. And with the money they're attracting, you can envision an employment model, a unionization model. And by the way, for those of us who are old enough to remember, when unions entered into the picture for professional athletics, there were dire predictions that they'll kill the sport, they'll kill fan interest. To the contrary, that hasn't occurred at all. These franchises are worth billions of dollars. Pick your sport, pick your team. We're talking billions, not millions. So I do think we're going to see this eventual separation between the SEC and Big Ten schools and the rest.
In our last few moments, Michael, we mentioned this Dartmouth case. You've brought up a couple others. What are you watching for next? What is the next shoe you're waiting for to drop here?
I'm curious to see if other Ivy League basketball players file a petition for representation. So, Rob, if only Dartmouth goes through with this, and let's just say, you know, the appeals result in victories for the athletes, you can't have a bargaining unit of one team. I mean, that there's no sports league that we have in this country that consists of one team. You have to have a league-wide bargaining unit. So the very first thing I'm interested in seeing is pick your next Ivy League school. Is there going to be one coming forward or not? I think that's going to be very telling. The other thing that enters in here is politics. We have a presidential election occurring. We have a pro-labor board, a pro-labor NLRB. If we get a Republican nominee, we're going to get a pro-NCAA labor board. That's just the way things are with the NLRB. When you get a Republican president, you get a narrowing of employment rights. When you get a Democratic president, you get an expansion. So those are the near-term things that I'm interested in seeing.
Thanks to our guest, Michael Leroy, professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, looking at college athletes and whether they're employees and able to unionize.